stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping
you? Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you?
You.
This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey everybody, welcome again to Call to Communion on this Tuesday afternoon, and we are delighted that you are with us today. This program, if it's new to you, well, let me tell you about it. This program is for our non-Catholic listeners, those of you who have questions about the Catholic faith, and you'd love to get those questions answered before moving on with your life as it is. So here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response. It'll be a quick robo-type response. Once you get it, text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. And of course, you can always send us an email. The address for that, ctc@ewtn.com. Pedro Quiles, our producer, Ace McKay handling the phones. Rich Jesse is on social media. If you'd like to ask a question via YouTube or Facebook, well, you can do that. Just put your question in the comments box. Rich will see that. He'll shoot it to us in Studio One, and we will get your question answered. Again, the phone number, 833-288-EWTN. I'm Tom Price. Very glad to be back with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
You know what? I'm doing great. Glad to be back with you. Last week, I was in Columbus. Helping St. Gabriel Radio, the fabulous station there, celebrate their 20th anniversary.
Fantastic.
So that was wonderful. Got to see some friends and family while up there and got some of that good Cincinnati food.
What'd you eat?
Let's see. If you're going to Cincinnati, you got to get a local chili. I don't want to give the brand name. And if you're also in the city, you've got to get this one particular brand of ice cream.
Okay.
And if I have my preference, it's going to be mocha chip.
So real health food trip this time.
You bet. Oh, yeah. Did I get on the scale today? No. The answer is no, I did not. We're going to lead off with this email from Ron in Michigan. Ron says, I have heard that in Catholic teaching, the human person is a body-soul composite, not just one or the other. So how do we reconcile this with the notion that the body separates from the soul at death, and then the two are reunited later at the resurrection? This seems to contradict the idea that the body and soul are an inseparable composite. Thanks, Ron in Michigan.
Yeah, thanks, Ron. I appreciate the question. So, first of all, the separability of soul and body is not something that is foregrounded in sacred scripture. So, in other words, when you read the Bible, you're not going to get a clear picture of the kind of standard Looney Tunes, Warner Brothers image of the, you know, Sylvester the cat dies and this little shady, translucent doppelganger cat with wings and a halo, you know, floats up and sits on the power line and watches the scene below as he proceeds to lose 8 more lives, you know, chasing Tweety Bird or whatever, and he keeps getting run over by steamrollers and stuff, you know, that image. Or the Patrick Swayze character in the movie Ghost with Whoopi Goldberg, where
sure.
he gets murdered in this, you know, again, the translucent Patrick Swayze doppelganger floats out of the body and
right.
then hangs around and gets into mischief, right? That's not, there's nothing like that in the scriptures, right?
Okay.
And that's not the way the scripture depicts the afterlife. In fact, the orientation of the Bible when it comes to the afterlife, especially in the New Testament, is wholly towards the resurrection of the dead. So the expectation of future life, it's not, hey, when I die, I get to float up there. It's, when I die, Christ will raise me again at the end of time. Now, that emphasis led some early Christians erroneously to assume that that's all there was, that there was just this life and then the resurrection. And so, and then there's a euphemism that you find in the book of Acts, where when people die, the text says, well, they fell asleep. It's just a euphemism for
right,
death.
Right.
But that led some people to the false conclusion of the doctrine of soul sleep or psychopanikia, that when you died, you just ceased to be conscious until Christ raises you again at the last day. And the reason I'm emphasizing this is while the Catholic Church does believe in the separability of body and soul, it's not the sort of the pop contemporary image that people have in their mind, right? So what the Church has done is it thinks philosophically about the human person. And it says, look, there's something about the human person that's oriented to God. And God is an immaterial spirit. God doesn't have a body. There's something in the human person that's oriented to the ethical life and to the rational life. And these things are clearly not material. You know, what are they? Well, it's hard to say what they are, but they're not material. They're not things. You know, not objects existing in the world. And so there's something about human personality, human cognition, that transcends, you know, just sort of bare substances knocking about, right? And in fact, it's more than that. I mean, you look at the power that humans have for abstraction. They conceive of abstract objects like triangles and the Pythagorean theorem, and you have it, you know, whatnot. These are clearly immaterial entities. It's hard to know what they are, but they're not matter, right?
Yeah.
And so there's something about the human person that's like that. And it's different, say, from dogs or cats. You know, my dog is not very adept to the Pythagorean theorem, I can tell you, right? And so this is where we infer the immateriality of the human person. But of course, that occurs in a thoroughly material medium, right? I mean, I am my body, and my intellectual activity is completely dependent on my brain and my neurology. So somehow, this hunk of squishy thing that I am is productive of these immaterial qualities, and I don't know quite how they fit together. Well, the Church says here's how they fit together. It actually borrows this idea from Aristotle, from the Hellenistic philosopher, that the soul is the way the human body is structurally and functionally organized. That partakes of this immaterial dimension of reality, right? And so, yes, there's an immaterial aspect of the human person, but it's one that's utterly embedded in and conditioned by and structured around its material aspect. How they come apart, well, that's what death is. Now, the real mystery is how does that immaterial part continue to consciously exist without the body? And in that, it's just dependent on the power of God to keep it going.
Ron in Michigan, thanks so much for your question. Hey, lines are open for you right now at 833-288-EWTN, 833-288-3986 for Call to Communion. It's Call to Communion on this Tuesday afternoon here on EWTN. Our phone number, and we do have lines open for you right now, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. EWTN has something wonderful for you. It's a free ebook, Prayers for the Conversion of a Loved One. This wonderful ebook, absolutely free, will encourage you as you pray for the conversion or reversion of your family and friends. And we've all got them in our families, right? Here's how you get it. EWTN.com/conversion of Saint Paul. I'll give you that again. EWTN.com/conversion of Saint Paul. Check it out. It is a free ebook, Prayers for the Conversion of a Loved One. Call to Communion here on EWTN. This is a great question from Tom, and it can be answered in one word, David. I don't think that's what he's looking for. So the question, as written, the question is, should people be cremated or buried?
Yes.
I knew it. I knew you would say that. But I don't think that's what Tom is looking for.
Yeah. I understand. So the traditional practice in the Catholic Church is for burial, but it allows cremation, has allowed cremation since the 1983 Code of Canon Law, provided the cremation is not chosen for superstitious reasons. And you say, well, Anders, what's a superstitious reason? Well, something like, let's say, granddad really loved the Smoky Mountains, and you think, well, if we cremate him and scatter his ashes over, you know, we climb up to the top of Mount LeConte in Gatlinburg and then, you know, open up a box and hurl them to the winds, that his spirit will somehow be diffused across the forest and, he'll be at peace, you know. That would be a superstitious reason.
Okay.
Right?
All right.
Dumping your ashes in the Ganges River so you can obtain a favorable reincarnation. That would be a superstitious reason, that sort of thing.
Okay.
It would be a legitimate reason to cremate. Well, I can't afford burial. You know, and this is a convenient way to do it. Or there's no Catholic cemetery nearby, and I'd like my loved one's remains to be reposed in the columbarium of my parish, right, where I could properly remember him. Those would be appropriate reasons. So, provided it's not for a superstitious reason, you can cremate. But the preference for burial derives from the Catholic doctrine of the resurrection of the dead and the dignity of the body, right? And it seems more fitting with the Catholic doctrine of the human person.
Okay. Tom, thanks so much for your question. Here's one now from Will, who says, in the creeds, it says that Jesus descended into hell and rose after 3 days. Jesus tells the good thief that on this day, the crucifixion, you will be with me in paradise. How could he be in heaven and hell at the same time?
Oh, you're assuming that paradise is heaven.
Oh.
And I think that's not the right assumption, right? Oh. I think we have to assume that Jesus is going to be with the fellow in the limbus of the fathers, which is what the church actually teaches.
Okay, very good. Carla has this one. Oh, well, let me give you the phone number before we get to Carla. 833-288-EWTN, if you have a question for Dr. David Anders. 833-288-3986. All right, here we go with Carla. Can a priest obligate a person in confession for their penance to tell their sins to the person that they have wronged?
No.
Can't do that.
Can't do that. Sorry. And here's something else that a priest can't do. And every once in a while, you'll find a priest who tries to do this because he's not well informed and he can't do it. He cannot condition the absolution upon your agreement to perform a particular penance. I'll only absolve you if you promise to dot, dot, dot. He can't do that. Sorry.
Okay.
Can't do it. And you can always ask a priest for a different penance.
Really?
Yeah.
I wonder how many people know that.
So one time, a relative of mine went to confession, and the priest gave a kind of ill-considered penance that started along the lines of, now, from now on, whenever you do blank, I want you to blank. And this person said, Father, you just gave me a penance that has no end date, right? Whenever I blank, I should blank, right?
Oh.
I can't be bound by that. This is a scrupulous individual who said this will torture me forever and I'll never have peace. Like, you can't, oh, you're right. I see that. Sorry. Okay. 2 Hail Marys. Thanks. Bye.
Well, there you go. Hey, thanks so much for your email, Carla. We're getting phones screened right now. You can join in as well at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. John sent us this email. How do we defend the seal of confession?
No, that's a good question.
Yeah.
So I think the best way to defend the seal of confession is, A, to talk about it, to affirm it, to celebrate it, to praise it, to thank priests for keeping it. And then, of course, if you live in one of these U.S. states where it has been challenged recently in a legal way, then you use every legal means at your disposal. In media, in organization, in activism, in legal proceedings, in lawsuits, you name it, you defend it to the hilt. Because here's one thing that priests are not going to do. They're not going to break the seal.
Yeah.
And so if you live in some state that says, well, we're going to make priests break the seal under these circumstances, well, all that means is, A, a certain class of people won't go to confession, and B, priests will end up in jail. Right. And so you're just not helping anything. Right. You're not helping anything if you try to, you know, I mean, I might call them well-intentioned, except I kind of think maybe they're not well-intentioned. But the otherwise seemingly well-intentioned legislatures that say, well, we're going to make the priests break the seal of confession if, for example, somebody confesses, like, you know, a sexual crime against a child in confession. I mean, like supposedly what would be a benign motivation for that? Well, you know, we're trying to protect kids. But if you stop and ask yourself, how is it actually going to protect kids? Because if someone's guilty of that kind of a thing, and they know, well, you know, if I go to the priest, he's going to turn me in. Well, he's not going to go to the priest.
Sure.
So, A, he's not going to confess it. So you've removed an opportunity for this guy or girl to begin to amend their life, right? So you're not helping protect children that way.
Yeah.
And then secondly, the priests are just not going to comply with the law. Just because you say you have to do this, they're not going to do it. They're not going to violate their conscience. And so, you know, if this, you know, somehow or another, the state were to get wind and actually prosecute this, it's hard to imagine how you'd prosecute it, but they actually attempt to prosecute it. What are you going to do? You're going to land this priest in jail. How's that protecting children? You're just taking somebody out of circulation whose job is to help people amend their lives. And, like, who do you want to amend their life? You want the, you know, Fulton Sheen said one time that hearing the confessions of nuns was like being pelted to death with cotton balls. You know, like, I mean, seriously, is that who priests are for? Like, they're just there to hear the confessions of little old nuns in convents that hadn't done anything wrong? Or do you want them out there in the trenches working with the, like, most desperate segments of humanity and the most deadly sinners who more than anybody else needs to get their lives together?
Yeah.
Like, do you really want to take, you know, God's shock troops out of circulation who are out there trying to change the thing and help people get closer to God, right? The only motivation for this that I can see is that a non-Catholic legislator has just been utterly saturated with anti-Catholic propaganda and has a completely unrealistic view of the priesthood.
Mm.
And you know, there have been priests that have done terrible things. They are a minority of the priesthood. But in popular consciousness, you would think that every priest was a pedophile because it's the only thing that lands in the media.
Sure.
Right? Do you think that your local paper is going to run a story that leads, you know, Father John spends 50 years in selfless service to parish, you know, and dies nameless and is buried in an unmarked grave, you know? Like, no, they're not going to run that story because it's not interesting. So for every 50 Father Johns, there's, you know, or 100 Father Johns, there's one scoundrel. He's the guy that gets the headline.
Sure.
He's the guy that gets the headline.
And, you know, it's amazing because, well, here we are now beginning July of 2025. This thing, some state will introduce this. This has been going back years, decades at least, that we're going to make this into law, and it never succeeds. It ends up getting pulled.
Well, it hasn't yet, but there have been states, not the United States, but there have been countries. There have been polities in the world that have, in fact, sought to force priests to violate the seal of confession, and in consequence, there have been priests that have been martyred for refusing to violate the seal of confession.
Wow.
So, I mean, if that's what you want to do, you want to create martyred and, you know, and persecuted priests, and you just have it out for the Catholic Church, then, I mean, that's why I say I wonder about the purity of your motivation, because it's not actually going to help victims.
One more thing to pray about, for sure. All right. If that, we hope that is very helpful for you. Thanks so much for your question. If you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN, beginning here with Stephanie in Michigan, listening on the EWTN app. Hello, Stephanie. What's on your mind today?
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I have a nephew that him and his wife have been trying to conceive a child for at least 3 years. They do not practice the Catholic faith, and the doctors have turned them to IVF. With that said, they have a GoFundMe page up on the internet now. This is my sister's son, and obviously, being that close, I feel the need to support somehow. However, I definitely don't want to do that and by putting my Catholic faith in danger. And so I am just curious, what would be a good thing for me to do, or how do I support them without supporting the cause?
Yeah, thanks. Well, it goes without saying that you don't send money to the GoFundMe campaign. Yeah. You do not do that. It depends on the nature of the relationship you have with your nephew. I mean, with a certain kind of nephew, you could write them a note and tell them that you're praying for them and you're concerned about them and, you know, your heart goes out to them and you could be a friend to them. And, I mean, there's all kinds of ways you can show your goodwill without collaborating in an objectively evil act.
And there it is, Stephanie. Thanks so much for your question. Hey, that opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, 833 888-398-3986. Glad you're with us for this Tuesday afternoon edition of Call to Communion on EWTN. Let's go now to Susan in Springfield, Massachusetts, listening online, EWTN.com. Hello, Susan. What's on your mind today?
Hi, Doctor. I'm calling because I've been in, I'm 73. I'm a very daily Mass goer to the modern Mass. I don't go to the Latin Mass, but I grew up with it. And I've been in the same parish, and I go to a cathedral for over 35 years. And everywhere I've been in my life during the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass, they always use bells to announce the sacrifice, you know, three times for the host and for the chalice. And last month I went to the cathedral, and they started using a gong at the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass. And I really, it really bothered, it upset me. And so I wrote a letter, and they kept doing it. And so I wrote a letter to the bishop and to the pastor asking why they had changed from the bells to the gong. And I also, you know, said that the Catholic Church has always been bells. And is there any, the Vatican approved this? Like, why did you do this change? And I hope you'll
Nope. Yeah, thanks, Susan. I really appreciate the question. And I have to be honest with you, this is an area of church law that I know very little about personally. So I don't know, I do not personally know if there's any instruction that's on point here. Now, you said this was at the cathedral church, I believe. Generally speaking, you know, the cathedral churches kind of tend to toe the line with church policy. I mean, that doesn't mean there can't be exceptions to that, but my suspicion would be that this is not violating some liturgical norm, but I honestly don't know that for a fact, so I can't tell you definitively. But there is something about this that I would like to comment on, and that is that St. Thomas Aquinas says that custom should more often than not have the force of law. And the reason why is that even if something's not officially prescribed in uh-huh. positive law, uh-huh. if the faithful have been doing a thing for a long time in a certain way, and you change it arbitrarily, then you destabilize their orientation in the liturgy or in the life of faith. Mm-hmm. And you risk, you know, if you destabilize them enough, they may become disaffected from the church, right? And so he warns, Thomas does, against arbitrary changes in custom, which more often than not, he says, if they're longstanding and well-received, should have the force of law, just if for no other reason than that you just not destabilize people in this way. So even if there's not a specific prescription in the law that would invalidate this, I think it's not wrong for you to express your concerns. You know, provided you know at the end of the day, it's going to be the bishop's discretion as to how he responds.
Very good. Susan, thanks so much for your question there from Springfield, Massachusetts. It's called a communion here on EWTN. Do you remember years ago, we took a call from someone who was saying that at the elevation, that someone would do a drum roll rather than a...
Oh.
Do you remember that?
No, I don't, but that would get under my skin, because there's such a cultural association with the drum roll.
Yeah.
You know, that, I mean, I would be waiting for Johnny Carson to come out and yell the punchline or something.
Well, I'm sure, you know, they meant well.
I'm sure they meant well.
It's like, this is it. Okay. But, yeah. You know, okay, we've got to leave that one right there. In a moment, we're going to talk with Doug in Oregon. We have almost sold out phones, but we've got one line open at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, 833-288-3986. Call to communion on this Tuesday afternoon on EWTN. Glad you're with us for the Tuesday afternoon edition of Call to Communion here on EWTN, the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters This program is for you. Call 833-288-EWTN. Love to chat with you today. Hey, congratulations going out to another great EWTN radio partner, now celebrating 6 years with us, KKSJ. That is 107.5 FM, serving Beloit, Kansas. Congratulations to Doug and his great team at Cornerstone Charitable Foundation from your friends here at EWTN. All right, let us go now to Doug in Oregon, listening on the great Modern Day Radio. Hey, Doug, what's on your mind today, sir?
Greetings to you, Tom, and to Dr. Enders. A quick follow-up to the drum roll. After the drum roll, the lector could say, "Here's Jesus."
Oh, no. Maybe I shouldn't have even brought this up. I don't know. I just happened to remember it after he mentioned gong. I thought, well, here's another musical instrument. What's
yeah,
on your?
I thought of that when Dr. Enders mentioned Johnny Carson. Anyway,
sure.
Is there any scriptural reference or Catholic tradition, or maybe just speculation or conjecture about what Jesus did between his death and his ascension 40 days later?
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. So what the scriptures tell us is that during the 40 days after he suffered and died, he appeared to the apostles from time to time.
That's it.
That's what we know. So Acts 1:3 says that he appeared to them from time to time. So what was he doing when he was not appearing? No idea. No idea.
That's where we got to leave it, Doug. Appreciate your call from Oregon. It is called a communion here on EWTN. Let's go to Wichita, Kansas, and talk with Hank, listening to the great Divine Mercy Radio. Hey, Hank, what's on your mind today, sir?
Yes, I was calling about the poor souls in purgatory,
mm-hmm.
and I heard this song called Dancing in the Fire, and it got me to thinking that if souls are in purgatory, eventually they will be released, for lack of a better term, and that they will see the beatific vision in heaven. So I was curious, is there some sort of happiness in purgatory, even though you may be in extreme pain or torture? Or
yes,
just
yes.
What Dr. Enders might think about
yeah,
that.
Yeah, thank you very much. So St. Catherine of Genoa wrote about purgatory, and you know her writings are not dogma, but they are venerable, and we're encouraged to read them.
Uh-huh.
Catherine Genoa said that souls in purgatory are happier than anybody on earth. And if you think about it for about 2 seconds, I think you can see why. So what is the condition of a soul in purgatory? Well, first of all, it's confirmed in charity. It will never lose the love of God. It will never stop loving God, and God will never stop loving it. It also has absolute unshakable certainty in its own salvation. It's not in any way tempted by the flesh. It has no worries. It has no anxiety. And so, you know, it's hard to imagine what kind of pains the soul in purgatory could have left. It doesn't have a body, so it doesn't have pains of sense.
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, and I'm not, this is me now, so this isn't definitive, but I'm sitting here trying to rack my brains thinking, what does a soul in purgatory actually suffer? And it strikes me that maybe the biggest pain or suffering that the soul in purgatory has is simply anticipation,
yeah,
longing. You mm-hmm. know, all my analogies are just terrible, horrible, rotten analogies. Okay, so here's a very inappropriate analogy because it's the only thing I think of.
Right? Okay,
first rock concert I ever went to in my life, Van Halen, 1984.
Oh my!
Okay, came to Birmingham, Jefferson Civic Center, and I was 13 years old. And I was so excited to go see Van Halen. I was about to bust a gasket, right? and I don't know if you've ever wanted something so bad that you start to have these irrational fears that it won't appear as promised, you know. So I started running through all these horrible scenarios, like, you know, the power goes out, or the band decides to do stand-up comedy instead, or like all these reasons why they wouldn't actually get up there and perform. It's all ridiculous, you know. But it was all born out of my like, I wanted to go to that concert so badly, you know. And so that was kind of a discomfort. But at the same time, it was a discomfort motivated by a really sort of misplaced but really intense love. You know, it was just a fascination, total infatuation with the band. It was so eager to participate. And maybe the pain of purgatory is a little bit like You know, a 13-year-old longing to go see the Van Halen concert in 1984. You know, I've got my heart set on this, and I can't wait to get there, and I'm not there yet. Gosh, I want to be. But yeah. it's also shot three with kind of joy. And I think that's what Catherine of Genoa is telling us about the souls in purgatory.
Thanks so much for your call today. Hank from Wichita called to communion here on EWTN. Let's go to Cynthia now. She is in Oregon, listening on Sirius XM channel 130. Hey, Cynthia, what's on your mind today?
Hi. I have a Protestant friend, and we've been talking back and forth. And recently she asked me about the Eucharist and the true presence. And she was wondering if Jesus consumed himself during the Last Supper.
It would seem so. It would seem so. Although, you know, he doesn't actually, the text actually doesn't say that. The text says that Jesus, you know, broke the host and the chalice and said, "Here, take, eat. This is my body." Right. We don't actually have a description of him consuming it. Now, what the fathers say when they address this question, Augustine, in particular, says that Christ, we do know that he held the consecrated host.
Yes.
So Augustine says of Christ that he held himself in his own hands.
I love that.
He held himself in his own hands. And the disciples, this is a really interesting thing, when the disciples consumed the consecrated host, they were consuming the same body and blood that was seated with them at table. But, of course, in a different mode.
Yeah.
He's present in the Eucharist in a substantial mode, not in the physical mode, right? Meaning it's devoid of accidents like, you know, like place and position and color and weight and all that sort of thing.
Cynthia, is that helpful for you?
Yes, thank you.
Thanks so much for your call from Oregon. Call to communion here on EWTN. Still time for your phone call. We'll try to get in as many as we can. 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. If you'd rather text us, you can do it. Text the letters EWTN to 58177. Regina, listening to us in Burbank, Illinois, listening online, EWTN.com. Hello, Regina. What's on your mind today?
Hi. Yes, I was just responding to that lady who was talking about the gong during the consecration.
Yes.
I'm on the southwest side of Chicago, and I belong to a Polish-English parish, and our parish does that. They do the gong and the bells at the consecration, and I asked about it because I thought I was kind of like that noise because it always bothers me during Mass, but I was told that it's a Polish custom.
Could be. Thank you. That would be interesting. I mean, I don't know much about Polish Catholicism, but I do know that particular embellishments to the liturgy definitely take on cultural accretions. Tom mentioned a few minutes ago a very misplaced and ill-judged parish that once led up to the Eucharist with a drum roll, which I think we would agree is a bit inappropriate.
Yeah.
But again, talk about a cultural accretion.
Yeah.
That's a you know, very 20th century North American kind of gesture, right? So cultures will do this sort of thing.
That's actually what it could be there. Regina, thanks so much for your call from Burbank, Illinois. Call to communion here on EWTN. Let's go to Phoenix now, and we'll talk with David. David is listening also on Sirius XM channel 130. Hey, David, what's on your mind today, sir?
Thank you. What is there a distinction between what Jesus said on the cross? Is there a difference between paradise and heaven? Aren't they identical?
No.
What Jesus said on the cross?
No, they're not identical, and I appreciate the question. So the Catholic doctrine is that Christ ascended to the dead, and he descended not to the hell of the damned, but to the limbus of the fathers, the righteous dead of the old covenant, before the resurrection. And he had not ascended to the Father. And so he wasn't talking about the beatific vision when he spoke to St. Dismas, "Today you'll be with me in paradise." I mean, there's no other way to square that circle, right, mm-hmm. other than to draw a distinction between the paradise that he refers to from the cross and then, of course, the ultimate reward of the beatific vision.
David, thanks so much for your call today. Here it's Call to Communion on EWTN. during the break, David and I were commiserating about pets that wake us up in the middle of the night. So am I right, David?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, it happened to me today. I'm sure it'll happen to you tomorrow. So if you're up early in the morning like we are, you may want to check out a wonderful program we have for you, Fire on the Earth. Peter Herbeck providing a compelling look at the new evangelization through inspiring teachings, interviews, and testimonies. Peter's great insights will help Catholics acquire the tools they need to do their part in the new evangelization. Peter is a wonderful host. I think you're going to love Fire on the Earth. Check it out weekdays, 5:15 a.m. Eastern. I'm up at 5:15. Maybe you are too. Monday through Friday morning, 5:15 a.m. Eastern, here on EWTN Radio. Let's go now to Jeffrey. Jeffrey's in Portland, Oregon, listening on the great Modern Day Radio. Hey, Jeffrey, what's on your mind today?
Hello, gentlemen, and good afternoon.
Howdy.
I had a quick question. I work for county government and have worked for county government for about 10 years.
Uh-huh.
And within that time, of course, there has been some initiatives to attend DEI trainings in some form or capacity. However, this has traditionally been voluntary. Recently, within the last month, our director has now pushed out new initiatives for a battery of two types of training that align with DEI measures. And within these components, of course, are transgender philosophy, homosexuality, marriage, acceptance, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a wide umbrella here. And I'm a little bit ambivalent about this because I do not want to attend these. And it's not because I don't wish ill will towards anybody. I want everybody to be happy and have the heart according to Jesus. However, I also don't want to associate with these types of measures. And I was wondering if maybe you could help me kind of lean one way or another towards what maybe I should or shouldn't do.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate the question. Well, I'm definitely sympathetic to your plight, and I wouldn't want to attend for a whole host of reasons, not the least of which is that I think I would find them just interminably boring, because I find radical ideological commitments that are not open to dialogue, they're not open to critical examination. I just find them pedantic and oppressive. And I don't care if they come from the left or the right or the north or the south. I mean, that way of approaching the human person, not just saying the transgendered ideology, any kind of ideology that's so reductive in its analysis of the human problem, to me just is just stultifying. And I would really rather watch paint dry. I mean, I really would. So I'm totally sensitive to your concerns. Now, you know, in terms of your participation, the church talks about, now, you know, I can guess what the content of this material is going to be. I don't know. So what I say, you know, may not be applicable, but I'll make an assumption here. Let's say that there's something here that's objectively wrong or maybe even objectively evil. The church's position on cooperation with evil is the following. We can never formally cooperate with evil. Right, you formally cooperate with evil, then you're guilty of the evil. And so, you know, let's say that someone, the objective here is to persuade a soul to do harm to themselves, and the ideology is put to the work of that persuasion. Well, you know, I'm not going to cooperate with that, right? I'm not going to formally cooperate with the end of trying to entice someone to self-harm through the medium, the instrument of some false reductive ideology, all right? Then there's material cooperation. And material cooperation is you're not trying to bring about that end, but you may be contributing some matter that helps bring about the end. And you know, there's two kinds. There's proximate and remote. Remote cooperation with evil, material cooperation, be something like this. Let's say you are a surgical instrument manufacturer. And so you make scalpels that could be used for a legitimate purpose, but they happen to find their way into the office of an abortion doctor, and he uses your scalpel to perform an immoral procedure. Well, you know, if you're the scalpel manufacturer, you certainly didn't formally intend that use, and even though you've materially contributed to it, your cooperation is fairly remote, and so you're innocent. Let's say you are the assisting nurse in the procedure, and the doc says, nurse, hand me the scalpel. And you say, well, you know, personally, I'm opposed to abortion, okay, but this is just a job. I got to make a living, so here's a scalpel. You may not formally intend the abortion, but your material cooperation here is upfront and personal. And yes. The church says, nope, can't do that. Sorry. Okay. If it's just a matter of sitting in a lecture, I'm a little bit hard pressed to see how either of these forms of cooperation come into play. Right? Am I formally cooperating? No. Am I materially cooperating? I don't think so. If I am, it's pretty remote. So I don't know that there would be, it would be immoral for you to go sit through some muddle-headed, reductive, ideological piece of drivel. But it would be very uncomfortable and distasteful, right? Now, you know, you might get a little bit testier if you are called upon to engage in all kinds of role plays and you know, asked to sign all kinds of manifestos and commit to all kinds of commitments, make all kinds of assurances about what you're going to do. And, you know, I mean, I, you know, it kind of depends on the nitty-gritty details then. But on the face of it, just the bare description is, you know, it's at best ambiguous to me, right? And it might even be, well, if not innocuous, at least not morally blameworthy on your part to attend if you're required to by your employer. But again, I could see some mitigating circumstances that could complicate that. Kind of depends on the details.
Jeffrey, is that helpful for you?
That helps a lot. I appreciate that. Just a quick follow-up. Of course, you know, I don't want to put my job into jeopardy, but yet I also didn't want to, you know, participate in something. So that's a huge help because I feel like with that answer, I can sit and just be in the class but don't have to participate in anything more than that.
So at the university level, this is something that young Catholics have to deal with all the time these days, right? Yeah. And what I usually tell kids that I talk to about this sort of thing is when they're sitting in a class and they're being handed out a bunch of, you know, brainless ideological dribble, is to say, look, what you do is in your answers on the tests and papers, you say, well, you know, from within the point of view of this class, you know, from the perspective given by the professor, according to this author, and then you're just stating a fact.
Yeah.
You know, you're just stating a fact.
Yeah.
Funny story on myself. When I was in college, I took a history of the novel course with a professor who I didn't find particularly engaging, but it became apparent to me was a pretty rabidly ideological feminist.
Okay.
And I was not the most motivated student as a college freshman. I got better as I went along, but as a freshman, I wasn't that motivated. And I quickly discerned I didn't actually have to read the books. I just had to write feminist manifestos on every essay and test. And I think I pulled an A- in that class without actually doing any work. You know, I found the lever to pull, you know.
Yeah, clearly.
And it was like, you know, well, in this novel, we learn that the treatment of women in Victorian England was just a buzzball, you know, and that was how I ran.
Yeah, right.
I'm not commending that approach. I'm just telling a personal story on myself. But neither did I say anything I didn't believe. It was all just like, you know, from the point of view of this author and within this frame of reference and so forth.
Jeffrey, thanks so much for your call. And the David Andrews Word of the Day. Stultifying.
It comes from the Latin word stultus, which means fool.
I'm going to remember that one. Mm-hmm. Eric is listening to us in Grand Rapids on the great Ave Maria radio. Hey there, Eric. What's on your mind today, sir?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So I do work as a DJ, and I'm a recent Catholic. And I have done weddings in the past where actually I do the music for the ceremony, and the ceremony is they're held like at barns and not necessarily at a church. So I'm just kind of wondering if there's some sort of concern participating in something that I shouldn't be by agreeing to do some of these ceremonies.
Yeah, thanks. So. I appreciate it. So Catholic teaching on marriage is that you do not have to be a Catholic to be validly married. You do not even have to be a Christian to be validly married. So two atheists can be validly married. Two Buddhists can be validly married. If they are, they have what's called a natural marriage. It's not a sacramental marriage. It's a natural marriage, but it's still good and it's valid, okay? Provided that they intend more or less what the Catholic Church means by marriage, which is to say you got a man, you got a woman, they intend to make a family together by some form of sexual cooperation, and the, you know, they presume fidelity and exclusivity, right? So if that's the kind of thing that you're doing, non-Catholics obviously have no canonical obligation to marry in a Catholic church. There's no reason in principle that a non-Catholic wedding could not take place in a barn, right? I mean, I wouldn't advise it, but it's, I mean, like, it, there's still kind of the note of the sacred about even a secular wedding, and it's appropriate to have it sort of hemmed about with some sort of gestures towards sacrality, but it doesn't have to be explicitly Catholic or Christian. You might get into a little bit of a more of a question, you know, like the famous legal case about the wedding cake, if you remember that one. You know, do you want to participate in a ceremony where on the face of it, the thing is obviously not what the Catholic Church means by a wedding? That's a different question. But no, there's nothing in principle wrong with a non-Catholic person not having a Catholic wedding.
Eric, thanks so much for your call from Grand Rapids. Glad you're listening to us on this Tuesday afternoon edition of Call to Communion. Got this one from Scott, who is watching us on YouTube today. Scott says, Dr. Anders, many Protestants say it was finished at the cross. Why do we believe that we must continue doing things in the New Testament that were foreshadowed in the Old Testament?
Yeah, thanks. Well, when Jesus said it was finished, he meant what he said and said what he meant. So the Old Testament sacrificial system was done away with, and the temple curtain was ripped in two from top to bottom. And so we no longer have to offer goats and bulls in sacrifice at the temple in Jerusalem. So that's finished.
There it is. Scott, thanks for watching us on YouTube. Mary is listening to us today in Houston on Sirius XM, Channel 130. Hi, Mary. What's on your mind today?
Yes, I would like to comment on the thing on the IVF and what to do.
Mm-hmm.
So knowing that IVF is a very, very sensitive subject, or infertility in general, but have they ever thought about doing the natural family planning course, and she could pay for that because you're doing it like in reverse, you know, to get pregnant? And the other thing is, could she go pay for them to go see, to go to the actual course of natural family planning? And also, there's a Catholic doctor, I think it's in Nebraska or Iowa, that they do, quote, if you want to say it, a Catholic version, you know, that help people get pregnant, women get pregnant.
You know, these are very good points, and I deeply appreciate them. And you're right that there are insights that have been gleaned from Catholic natural family planning practices that not only can help space pregnancies, but can also aid in fertility. If I'm not mistaken, and I could be mistaken about this, but if I'm not mistaken, there is an organization called FEMM, F-E-M-M, I believe that's the agency, that teaches the optimization of women's health, and it uses some of these same principles, but it's been very, very helpful to people who are seeking to conceive and to do so naturally without artificial means like IVF, right? And so there are a lot of resources out there that are church compliant that that do not resort to these means. Now, the real question is, how do you sell that to your non-Catholic friend, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it really depends on the quality of the relationship. The lady who called in, I think it was her nephew that she was addressing.
And I believe so, yeah.
You know, you gotta gauge the nature of the relationship very carefully when you go, you know, it's like, don't you love it when people hand you a book and go, Anders, this is the best book I've ever read. You've got to read this. And I'm like, I do. I do, right? I'll put it at the bottom of my stack of 50 books on my bedside table. You know, how do you get people to comply with your vision of reality? That's a little bit dicier. But in terms of the content of the advice, yeah, spot on, Mary. Absolutely spot on.
I believe that Mary is referring to Dr. Ted Pohlchick at the St. Paul or Pope Paul VI.
Pope Paul VI, yep.
So that would be a great resource. Yep. Again, if this person is open to it.
If they're open, exactly.
And sometimes, as a mutual friend of ours says, sometimes they just aren't in receive mode.
Aren't in receive mode.
Yeah, so that does happen. But Mary, some great, great ideas there. Thank you so much for that. I want to remind you once again that EWTN is everywhere. There are so many ways that you can listen to EWTN, including your local radio station, Sirius XM Channel 130. We're on just about every streaming platform there is. And of course, the EWTN app, always there for you. You can check that out and get that free download at EWTNapps.com. EWTNapps.com. Coming up in a couple of minutes on most of these EWTN stations, it is Open Line Tuesday with Father Wade Menezes. That'll be at 3 o'clock Eastern Time. Hey, Dr. David Anders, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
Don't forget, we do this program Monday through Friday right here on EWTN at 2 p.m. Eastern, followed by, as I mentioned there, Open Line. So check us out. You can also check out the podcast whenever you wish. Go to EWTN's Podcast Central. It's at EWTN.com/radio. Look for the words Podcast Central. On behalf of our fantastic team, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders. Thanks for joining us. See you tomorrow here on EWTN's Call to Communion. God bless.